Thank you, Dr. Dorsey, and good evening. It goes without saying that for an event of this caliber and for a topic of the significance and complexity that restorative justice is, it was critical that we have just the right speaker for tonight's lecture. Michelle Alexander was selected as that person for a variety of reasons. A graduate of Vanderbilt University and Stanford Law School, Ms. Alexander is today a highly acclaimed civil rights lawyer and legal scholar. Early in her career, she served as a law clerk for Justice Harry A. Blackmun on the United States Supreme Court. In more recent days, she has been a guest on numerous television programs, including the Colbert Report. She has experience in both the private and the nonprofit sectors of our society, having served as director of the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU of Northern California, as well as serving as an associate at a large California law firm where she specialized in class action lawsuits alleging race and gender discrimination. Today, Ms. Alexander is associated with Ohio State University, where she holds a joint appointment in the Moritz College of Law and the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Her experiences as a lawyer and as a thinker contributed to her path-breaking book on incarceration in our society today, entitled The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And as many of you are aware, this provocative and unsettling book suggests to all of us that a new system of racial control, different but just as damaging as the old, is taking place today through the dramatic incarceration of African American men in our society, demanding our attention and forming a call for a new movement for racial justice in the United States. Through this book, Michelle Alexander has become a leading voice in the conversation around incarceration, restorative justice, and community health. In that role, she is helping us think more deeply about fairness in our society, about repair work that leads to safer communities, and about a better future built on lessons learned from our past. It is a distinct honor to welcome author, scholar, and activist Michelle Alexander as our keynote speaker for the 2012 Crost Symposium.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me here tonight. It's truly an honor to be invited, and I am thrilled to be surrounded by so many people committed to having meaningful conversation about this system of mass incarceration, a system that has decimated so many of our families, destroyed so many of our communities, and literally turn the clock back on racial progress in the United States. I'm especially happy to be having this conversation here in Texas. In many respects, Texas is the birthplace of mass incarceration. Historian Robert Perkinson has documented in his excellent book, Texas Tough, the ways in which Texas has led the nation in its race to incarcerate, providing the template for what has become a more racially divided, fearful, and vengeful society, a model that no longer seeks to repair or redeem or restore, but instead seeks only to marginalize, warehouse, dispose, and permanently brand all those deemed as criminals. But there is a ray of hope, for after leading the nation in a race to incarcerate, Texas is now taking a turn. And for the first time in the state's history, Texas has closed a prison, and rates of incarceration are beginning to dip here in this state, and it appears that Texas might, just might, be able to lead the nation in a rethinking about the prison system we have constructed. There's an opening right now, an opening for meaningful dialogue about this system of mass incarceration as politicians across the political spectrum are beginning to wonder out loud whether the prison state that has been constructed in recent decades truly is defensible. I think the question, though, is whether Texas will lead us to a bold, more inclusive, more compassionate, hopeful future, or whether we will reach a new plateau of indifference. I'm deeply concerned that so many of the very modest reforms that we've seen here in Texas and in some other states across the country have not been motivated by genuine care, compassion, and concern for those who have been locked up and locked out, but instead have been motivated simply by a desire to balance state budgets in a time of economic crisis. And these very narrow fiscal concerns, which have motivated some of this reform, I believe will likely lead to very narrow, very modest reform over the long haul, unless there is a major shift in public consciousness, an awakening to what we as a nation have done again. We stand now truly at a fork in the road, and I hope we will not sleep through this moment in our history. The time is ripe for truly transformational change, not mere tinkering with this machine that we've created. And I hope and pray that we will rise to the challenge that this moment in history presents. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. once said there is, quote, nothing more tragic than to sleep through a revolution, end quote. And he was talking at that time about a profound moral revolution that was underway, a struggle for the recognition of the dignity and humanity of all humankind, a struggle to end what was America's prevailing caste system at the time, known as Jim Crow. And in the months before his death, he told an audience the story of Rip Van Winkle, who famously fell asleep for 20 years. He explained that when Rip began his extended nap, there was a sign emblazoned on the wall of a nearby inn that had a picture of King George III of England on it. But when Rip Van Winkle woke up 2 decades later, that sign had a picture of George Washington on it. And Dr. King explained that what is most striking about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not that he had slept for 20 years, but that he had slept through a revolution. He said, quote, there are all too many people who, in some great period of social change, fail to achieve the new mental outlooks that the new situation demands, end quote. Well, I think his words are as relevant today as they were back then. You know, many of us, myself included, have slept through a revolution, actually a counter-revolution that has blown back so much of the progress that Dr. King and so many other racial justice advocates risked their lives for and some died for. This counter-revolution has occurred with barely a whimper of protest, even as millions of people, have been rounded up, locked in literal cages, branded criminals or felons, and then stripped of the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. While many of us have been asleep, a vast new system of racial and social control has emerged, one that would certainly have Dr. King turning in his grave. I think one day we may look back and wonder how we could have possibly slept for so long. Well, I've been asked to share with you today the thesis of my book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, and to a large extent, the title of the book speaks for itself. I argue that today, in the so-called era of colorblindness, and yes, even in the age of Obama, Something akin to a caste system is alive and well in America. The mass incarceration of people of color is tantamount to a new caste system, one specifically designed to address the social, political, and economic challenges of our time. It's a system that shuttles children from decrepit, underfunded schools to brand new high-tech prisons. It's a system that locks poor people, overwhelmingly poor folks of color, into a permanent second-class status, eerily reminiscent of one we supposedly left behind. It is a system that is, in my view, the moral equivalent of Jim Crow. Now, I have to admit that there was a time when I rejected this kind of talk. There was a time when I resisted comparisons between mass incarceration and slavery or mass incarceration and Jim Crow, believing those kinds of claims and those kinds of comparisons were exaggerations, were distortions, were hyperbole. In fact, there was a time when I thought that people who made those kinds of claims and those kinds of comparisons were actually doing more harm than good to efforts to reform our criminal justice system and achieve greater racial equality in the United States. But what a difference a decade makes. For after years of working as a civil rights lawyer, representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality, and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement in poor communities of color, and attempting to assist people released from prison re-enter into a society that had never shown much use for them in the first place, I had a series of experiences that began what I now call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that is just so obvious to me now that what seems odd in retrospect is that I had managed to be blind to it for so long. As I describe in the introduction to the book, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices that we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways in which it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, and exclusion from jury service, are suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. But like I said, I didn't reach this conclusion. I didn't get to this point easily. I resisted it for quite some time. But I had a series of experiences that began to open my eyes, and one in particular I'll never forget. It involved a young African-American man, about 19 years old. He walked into my office one day and forever changed the way I viewed not only our criminal justice system, but how I viewed myself as a civil rights lawyer and advocate. At the time, I was the director of the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU in California, and we had launched a major campaign against racial profiling by the police. We called it the DWB campaign, or the Driving While Black or Brown campaign. And we had already sued the California Highway Patrol for racial profiling and their drug interdiction practices, but we were looking to sue some other law enforcement agencies as well, police departments, you know, that we had received complaints about regarding discriminatory practices and tactics. And so we had created a hotline number for people to call if they believed they'd been stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. And we put this hotline number up on billboards in Oakland and San Jose and other cities around California, urging people to call the hotline number if they believed they'd been stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. And in fact, within the first few minutes of us announcing the hotline number on the evening news, we received thousands of calls. Our system crashed temporarily. We had to expand our capacity. And so I was spending my day interviewing one young black or brown man after another who had called the hotline reporting discriminatory treatment by the police. And it was getting late in the day, and I was tired. I was ready to move things along. And this young man walks into my office carrying a stack of papers about this thick. He had taken detailed notes of his encounters with the police in his neighborhood in Oakland over a 9-month period of time. He had descriptions of every stop, frisk, search, every time his car was pulled over, every time he had been made to lie spread eagle on the pavement for no apparent reason other than race. He had names of witnesses who could corroborate the story, people who were present with him or who witnessed it. He had names of officers, in some cases even had badge numbers. Just an extraordinary amount of detail and documentation of this pattern of police stops that he'd experienced. And the stories he was telling me about what the police were doing in his neighborhood were corroborated by other stories we had heard about what was going on in Oakland. And so I started to get excited. I started thinking, well, here, maybe he's our dream plaintiff. Maybe he's the one we've been looking for who could be our lead plaintiff in our suit against the Oakland Police Department. So I started asking him more questions, and I can see he's very well spoken. He's a good-looking young man. I think he'll do well with the media. I'm getting more and more excited, and then he says something that makes me pause. And I say, "What did you just say? You know, did you just say you're a felon? Did you just say you're a drug felon?" We had been screening people with prior criminal records. When people called the hotline, we would send a form to them to fill out, asking them a bunch of questions about their experiences with the police, and one of them was, "Have you ever been convicted of a felony?" We believed we could not represent someone as a named plaintiff in a racial profiling case if they had a felony record, because we knew that if we did, law enforcement and the media would be all over us saying, "Well, of course the police should be keeping a close eye on him. He's a felon." And we knew that we wouldn't be able to put him on the stand in the courtroom without him being cross-examined for an hour in front of the jury about his prior criminal history, you know, undermining his credibility for the jury and distracting the jury's attention away from the conduct of the officers and turning it into a trial of past criminal conduct of our client. And so we had been screening people with prior criminal records, and he had not checked the metaphorical box on the form. And so I'm looking at him saying, are you a felon? Are you a drug felon? And he gets quiet. He just stares down at the table for a while. And then finally he looks up and looks me right in the eye, and he says, yeah, I'm a felon. I'm a drug felon, but let me tell you what happened. The police planted drugs on me, and they framed me, and they set me up, and they beat up me and my friend." And starts going this whole long story about how he was framed and set up, and drugs were planted on him. And I was just like, I'm sorry. I'm not going to be able to represent you. I tried to explain to him why that was the case, why I could understand he would feel that was wrong or unfair, but cannot represent you if you have a felony record. And he becomes agitated, starts trying to give me more facts and information, names of the officers that were involved and all of this. And I'm like, "I am sorry. I cannot represent you." And then finally he becomes enraged. And he says to me, "You're no better than the police. You're no better than the police. The minute I tell you I'm a felon, you just stop listening. You can't even hear what I have to say." He says, "What's to become of me? What's to become of me? I can't get a job anywhere because of my felony record. I can't get a job anywhere. It's like I can't even get housing. I can't even get access to public housing because of my felony record. I can't even qualify for food stamps because of my felony record. How am I supposed to feed myself? How am I supposed to take care of myself as a man?" He says, good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood they haven't gotten to yet. They've gotten to us all already. And he snatches all those notes up off the table and just starts ripping them up to tiny little pieces, throws them in the air. It's just snowing white paper in my office. He turns around, walking out, yelling at me, you're no better than the police. I can't believe I trusted you. And he walks out. Well, several months after that, I'm doing a public access television show that's being broadcast live out of his neighborhood. I was doing public access TV because we were trying to organize several thousand people to attend a major demonstration against the governor's refusal to sign racial profiling legislation. And we had been holding town hall meetings up and down the state and doing a large media campaign. And it was a couple days before the demonstration. And so I was doing public access TV, urging people to get on the bus, go to the demonstration, make their voice heard. And it was broadcasting live out of his neighborhood. Well, the minute the show goes off the air, he comes bursting into the studio carrying this dirty potted plant, and he rushes up to me, and he's emotional, on the verge of tears, and he says, I'm just here to tell you I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for the way I treated you. I've been seeing you on the news. I've been seeing you out there trying to fight for our people, trying to do the right thing, and I shouldn't have spoken to you like that. I shouldn't have treated you like that. It's like, I would have bought you some flowers, but I still don't have any money. I snatched this plant off of my grandma's front porch here. And he just thrusts it into my arms, and then he turns around and starts running out of the building. I go chasing after him. He jumps into this broke-down car and takes off, disappears. Well, several months after that, I'm in my office. I open up the newspaper. What's on the front page? Well, the Oakland Writers police scandal is broken. It turns out that a gang of police officers, otherwise known as a drug task force, had been planting drugs on suspects, beating folks up in his neighborhood, and who's identified as one of the main officers accused of planting drugs on suspects and beating folks up? Well, it's the officer he had identified to me as having planted drugs on him and beat up him and his friend. And it was really only then that the light bulb finally started to go on for me, and I thought to myself, he's right about me. I'm no better than the police. You know, the minute he told me he was a felon, I stopped listening. I couldn't even hear what he had to say. And I started to ask myself some hard questions of myself as a civil rights lawyer. How am I actually replicating the very forms of discrimination, exclusion, marginalization that I'm supposedly fighting against? And I also asked myself, why is it that we haven't been able to find one young black man in his neighborhood they haven't gotten to yet? What is really going on here? And that began my journey of asking myself and others a lot of hard questions, doing an enormous amount of research, and listening more carefully to the stories of those cycling in and out of our prison system. And what I learned in that process was that my great crime wasn't in refusing to represent an innocent man. My great crime was in believing, assuming that there was some path to racial justice that did not include those we view as guilty. I also learned some facts that blew my mind. There are more African American adults under correctional control today, in prison or jail, or on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. As of 2004, more black men were disenfranchised than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. Now, of course, during the Jim Crow era, poll taxes and literacy tests operated to keep black folks from the polls. Well, today, felon disenfranchisement laws accomplish in many states what poll taxes and literacy tests ultimately could not. A black child born today has less of a chance of being raised by both parents than a black child born during slavery. This is due in large part to the mass incarceration of black men. There was an article published about this in The Economist magazine, of all places, entitled "How the Mass Incarceration of Black Men Harms Black Women." And the article explained that the majority of black women in the United States are unmarried, including about 70% of professional black women, and that this is due largely to the mass incarceration of black men, which takes them out of the dating pool at the years they would be most likely to commit to a partner or to a family. But what's worse is that by branding them criminals and felons at early ages, often before they're even old enough to vote, they're rendered permanently unemployable in the legal job market for the most part, virtually guaranteeing that most will cycle in and out of prison, sometimes for the rest of their lives. Now, this isn't a phenomenon that affects just some small segment of the African-American community. To the contrary, in many large urban areas today, more than half of working-age African-American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In some cities, cities like Chicago, Baltimore, Philly, some cities, the rates are much higher. In Chicago, for example, a study revealed that if you take into account prisoners, in other words, if you actually count prisoners as people, and prisoners are excluded from poverty statistics, from unemployment data, you know, thus masking the severity of racial inequality in the United States. But if you actually count prisoners as people, in the Chicago area, nearly 80% of working-age African-American men now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These men are part of a growing undercaste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race, relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. Now, I find that when I tell people now, today, that I think mass incarceration is like a new Jim Crow or a new caste-like system, people react with shock, disbelief. They say, "Oh, how can you say that? How can you say that? Our criminal justice system isn't a system of racial control. It's a system of crime control. And if black folks would stop running around committing so many crimes, they wouldn't have to worry about being locked up in mass and then stripped of their basic civil and human rights." But therein lies the greatest myth about mass incarceration, namely that it's been driven by crime and crime rates. It's not true. It's just not true. Our prison population quintupled in a 30-year period of time. Quintupled, not doubled or tripled, quintupled in a 30-year period of time. We now have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of even highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, and Iran. But this is not due simply to crime or crime rates. During that 30-year period of time, crime rates in the United States fluctuated. Went up, went down, went back up again, went down again. And today, as bad as crime rates are in many parts of the country, crime rates, you know, nationally are at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. Most criminologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have soared regardless of whether crime was going up or going down in any given community or the nation as a whole. So what explains this sudden explosion of incarceration, the birth of a penal system unprecedented in world history, if not crime and crime rates? Well, the answer is the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, the wave of punitiveness that washed over the United States. Drug convictions alone, just drug convictions, accounted for about two-thirds of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state prison systems between 1985 and 2000, the period of our prison system's most dramatic expansion. Drug convictions have increased 1,000% since the drug war began. I mean, to get a sense of how large a contribution the war on drugs has made to mass incarceration, consider this. There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980. Now, most Americans violate drug laws at some point in their lifetime. Most do. The research has been consistent in showing that. But the enemy in this war has been racially defined. Not by accident, this drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies have consistently shown for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. Or sell. Now, that defies our basic racial stereotypes about who a drug dealer is. You know, if you picture in your mind a drug dealer and you're honest, you likely picture some black kid standing on the street corner with his pants sagging down, somebody in the hood. Plenty of drug dealing happens in the hood, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. A white kid living in rural Texas or rural Nebraska does not drive to the hood to get his marijuana or his meth or his cocaine. No. He gets it most likely from someone of his own race down the road. The research shows that drug markets, much like American society generally, are fairly segregated by race. White folks typically sell to white folks, blacks to blacks, Latinos to each other. Drug markets are even segregated by class to a large degree. University students sell to each other. Drug dealing and drug use happens in all communities of all colors, but those who do time for drug crime are overwhelmingly black and brown. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, African American. Now, I find that most people, when they actually see the data, they say, oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. But, you know, we need to get tough on them. We need a war on them, those folks in the hood, because that's where the violent offenders are. That's where the drug kingpins can be found. In fact, in my experience, most people seem to imagine that the war on drugs was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities and the related violence. And in fact, for a long time, I myself believed that as well. But it's not true. The current drug war was officially declared in 1982 by President Ronald Reagan at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. He declared his drug war before, not after, crack began to ravage inner city communities across America. President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term a war on drugs, but President Ronald Reagan turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. And at the time he declared his drug war, drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise, and less than 3% of the American population even identified drugs as among the nation's most pressing concerns. So why declare a drug war at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline and not on the rise and the American public wasn't much concerned about it? Well, from the outset, the war on drugs had relatively little to do with genuine concern about drug abuse or drug addiction and nearly everything to do with politics, racial politics. Numerous historians and political scientists have now documented that the war on drugs was part of a grand Republican Party strategy known as the Southern Strategy of using racially coded get-tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare in order to appeal to poor and working-class whites, particularly in the South, who were anxious about, resentful of, fearful of many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. And to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge that it was poor and working class white folks that really had their world rocked by the civil rights movement. I mean, wealthy whites could afford to send their kids to private schools and give their kids all of the advantages that wealth has to offer. But poor and working class whites, many of whom were themselves struggling for survival, they faced a social demotion. It was their kids that might get bused across town to go to a school they believed was inferior. It was their kids and themselves that were suddenly forced to compete on equal terms for limited jobs with this whole new group of people they had been taught their whole lives to believe were inferior to them. And then to make matters worse, from their perspective, affirmative action programs created the impression that black folks were now leapfrogging over them on their way to Harvard or Yale or fancy jobs in corporate America. And this state of affairs created an enormous amount of fear, anxiety, resentment, anger, but it also created an enormous political opportunity. Pollsters and political strategists found that thinly veiled promises to get tough on them, a group not so subtly defined by race, could be enormously successful in persuading poor and working class whites to defect from the Democratic New Deal coalition and join the Republican Party in droves. It was part of the strategy to flip the South from blue to red. In the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, he explained the strategy this way, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they did. A couple years after crack hit the streets, the Reagan administration seized on the development with glee, hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, the so-called crack whores, and crack-related violence. The wave of media that surrounded the crack epidemic didn't happen just as a result of good investigative journalism. It was the product of a media campaign that was launched by the Reagan administration to bolster public support for a drug war they had already declared and persuade Congress to devote millions more dollars to waging it. And the plan worked like a charm. Almost overnight, television sets were saturated with images of black and brown drug dealers, crack babies, and a wave of punitiveness washed over the United States. State legislatures started passing harsh mandatory minimum sentences for minor drug offenses, sentences harsher than murderers receive in other Western democracies. And soon, Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove they could be even tougher on them than their Republican counterparts. And so it was President Bill Clinton who escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessors even dreamed possible. And it was President Bill Clinton who championed the laws banning drug offenders from federal financial aid for schooling upon release, banning drug offenders from access to public housing and making it difficult for people with criminal records to ever get access to public housing. It was the Clinton administration that championed the federal law banning people convicted of federal drug offenses from food stamps for the rest of their lives. To a large extent, the basic architecture of this new caste-like system was created by a Democratic administration desperate to win back those so-called white swing voters, the folks who had defected from the Democratic Party in the wake of the civil rights movement. Now, I find that even those who are familiar with this history will say, well, yeah, that's a shame, but we still need to get tough on them. Those folks in the hood, the violent offenders, what are we going to do about those drug kingpins and the violent offenders? in the hood. But what people don't realize is that this drug war has never been aimed primarily at rooting out the violent offenders or the drug kingpins. Federal funding in this war has flowed to those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost the sheer numbers of drug arrests. It's been a numbers game. Law enforcement agencies are rewarded in cash by the millions for the sheer numbers of people swept in to the system for drug offenses, which helps to explain why law enforcement officials so often go out looking for the low-hanging fruit, stopping, frisking, searching as many people as possible, pulling over as many cars as possible, searching them for drugs in the hopes of boosting their numbers of drug arrests to continue to qualify for federal grant money. And then to make matters worse, federal drug forfeiture laws authorize state and local law enforcement agencies to keep for their own use up to 80% of the cash, cars, homes seized from suspected drug offenders. You don't have to be convicted of a drug offense to have law enforcement keep the cash in your pocket or seize cash from your home or sell your car. No, if you're just suspected of a drug offense, law enforcement has the right to seize your property and keep it, 80% of it, for itself, for its own budget, thus granting to law enforcement a direct monetary interest, not in ending drug abuse or drug addiction or ever winning this war, but instead law enforcement has a direct monetary interest in the longevity of this war. And the results have been predictable. Overwhelming majority of people swept into the system for drug offenses have been arrested for relatively minor, nonviolent drug offenses. In 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug arrests, simple possession. Only 1 out of 5 for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or any significant selling activity. And in the 1990s, the Clinton years, the period of the greatest escalation of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession, a drug that has been shown now to be less harmful, less addictive than alcohol or tobacco, but at least, if not more prevalent, in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in the hood. But by waging this drug war almost exclusively in the hood, we've created this vast new racial undercast in an astonishingly short period of time. Now, many people have said to me, well, if that's the case, if that's all true, then why aren't you filing more class action lawsuits? Why not take this to the Supreme Court and bring an end to it all? What people don't realize is that the U.S. Supreme Court has closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. The cases that I was bringing 10 or 15 years ago can't even be filed today. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a series of cases, beginning with McCleskey versus Kemp and Armstrong versus United States, has ruled explicitly that it doesn't matter how overwhelming the statistical evidence might be. It doesn't matter how severe the racial disparities are. Unless you can provide proof of conscious, intentional bias, tantamount to an admission by a law enforcement official of racial bias, you can't even state a claim for racial bias in the criminal justice system today. Now, that poses quite a challenge, since most law enforcement officials, like the rest of us, know better than to state our racial biases out loud. Most police officers, when taking the stand, will not say, well, yeah, Your Honor, the reason I stopped him is because he was black. Most prosecutors would not say, well, Your Honor, I would have given him a better plea deal. I wouldn't have given him such a harsh sentence. I wouldn't have asked 25 years to life for a minor drug offense. But he was black. He's from the hood. It looks like he's never going to turn his life around. Most folks know better than to state their stereotypes and biases out loud. But more importantly, so many of the biases and stereotypes that drive law enforcement decision-making today operate on such an unconscious level that many good cops, good law enforcement officials couldn't even admit to themselves their biases if they tried. You know, a good cop, well-meaning cop trying to do his job, proactive policing, sees a group of young black kids walking down the street, their pants sagging a little bit down, and he thinks to himself, oh, I'm going to jump out, I'm going to stop them, I'm going to frisk them, see if they have anything on them. They're doing good, proactive police work. The idea would never occur to them, seeing a group of young white kids walking down the street. Now, that officer may not be meaning any harm to those young black kids, but those unconscious stereotypes about who seems guilty, who looks like they might be up to no good, hundreds of thousands of decisions like that are made over and over again, adding up to enormous racial disparities that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that we can't even challenge in a court of law. Now, it used to be the case, not so long ago, that the police could not just walk up to anyone on the street and stop them, question them, frisk them, search them without any evidence of criminal activity, without any reasonable suspicion or probable cause. But the police can do that today. The U.S. Supreme Court is given the police license to do precisely that as long as the police get consent. Now, what's consent? Consent is when a police officer walks up to a young man and the officer has one hand on his gun and he says, son, put your hands up in the air. So will you put your hands up in the air so I can frisk you, see if you got anything on you? And the young man says, yeah. That's consent. That young man just waived his Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. The police do not have to have a shred of evidence of any criminal activity to engage in that encounter. In fact, stop and frisk operations have become so routine in large cities that, well, in cities like New York City, it's reported that in 1 year alone, the New York Police Department stopped and frisked more than 600,000 people in 1 year. Overwhelmingly black and brown men. 600,000 people. The vast majority of those stops and searches, nothing was ever found. People thrown to the pavement, stopped and frisked, questioned about where they are, what they're doing, where they're going. Only a tiny fraction of those cases, of those stops and frisks, in many cases less than 10%, were, is anything, any kind of contraband or anything suspicious ever found. But those hundreds of thousands of stops and frisks per year add up to enormous disparities, and the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled we can't even challenge those practices in a court of law. In this way, the U.S. Supreme Court has immunized this system of mass incarceration from judicial scrutiny for racial bias, much in the same way that the U.S. Supreme Court rallied to the defense of Jim Crow and of slavery in their day. But of course, just being swept into this system with no hope of relief is just the beginning of the odyssey for so many, because once you've been swept in, you enter into a parallel social universe in which basic civil and human rights that apply to everyone else no longer apply to you. Once branded a felon, you find that for the rest of your life, discrimination is perfectly legal against you. Employment discrimination is perfectly legal. For the rest of your life, you must check that box on employment applications asking, have you ever been convicted of a felony? It doesn't matter if that felony happened 4 months ago, 4 weeks ago, or 45 years ago. The rest of your life, checking that box, knowing full well that the odds are sky high, that application is going straight to the trash. Many people say to me, oh, come on. You know, you're just making excuses for people. People released from prison, they could get a job somewhere. They could get a job somewhere if they tried. I mean, they could get a job at McDonald's. Getting a job at McDonald's is no easy feat if you have a felony record. Hundreds of professional licenses are off limits to people with felony records. In fact, in my state in Ohio, you can't even get a license to be a barber if you've been convicted of a felony. Housing discrimination, perfectly legal and routine. Private landlords as well as public housing agencies free to exclude people with criminal records. Public benefits, discrimination in public benefits perfectly legal, as I mentioned. You're deemed under federal law ineligible for food stamps for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug felony. Fortunately, a number of states have opted out of the ban on food stamps, people convicted of drug offenses at some point in their life, but still the case that thousands of people can't even get food to feed themselves, aren't worthy of being fed because they were once caught with drugs. What do we expect people to do? People released from prison, what do we expect them to do? Can't get a job, you're barred from housing, even food stamps may be off limits to you. Well, apparently what we expect them to do is to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support, which continues to accrue while you're in prison. And in a growing number of states, you're expected to pay back the costs of your imprisonment. And paying back all these fees, fines, court costs can be a condition of your probation or parole. And then get this, if you're lucky enough to actually get a job following release from prison, if you're one of the lucky few who actually manages to get that job, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished. 100%. To pay back all those fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. What do we expect folks to do? I think the better question may be, what does this system seem designed to do? Seems designed to send folks right back to prison, which is what, in fact, happens the vast majority of the time. About 70% of people released from prison return within 3 years, and the majority of those who return in some states do so in a matter of months because the challenges associated with mere survival on the outside are so immense. So what do we do? What do we do? Well, first, I think those of us in the civil rights community, we have to be willing to admit that we've allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch. While many of us were clinging to affirmative action or trying to hold on and protect the perceived gains of the past, millions of people, rounded up, swept into prisons and jails, locked into literal cages, and then released into a second-class status which they're stripped of the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. We've now spent $1 trillion just waging the drug war. A trillion. Funds that could have been used for education, funds that could have been used for job creation in the poorest communities, funds that could have been used for our collective well-being. Instead, those dollars paved the way for the destruction of countless lives, families, dreams. So what do we do? What do we do? Well, my own view is that nothing short of a major social movement has any hope of ending mass incarceration in America. Now, if you think surely something less would do, that there must be some way of tinkering with this machine, of electing right folks and getting it right, of fixing this system, consider this. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement really gained steam, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. 4 out of 5. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Most new prison construction has occurred in predominantly white rural communities, communities that now view prisons as source of jobs, economic base for towns across America. Many prisons have been sold to these communities as an answer to their economic woes, and very often the promises made to those communities do not bear out. But nonetheless, these communities now believe that their jobs, that their security depends on these prisons. Those prisons across America would have to close down. Private prison companies now listed on the New York Stock Exchange and doing quite well in a time of economic recession. Those private prison companies would be forced to go bankrupt, belly up, watch their profits just vanish. This system is now so deeply rooted in our social, political, and economic structure that it is not going to just fade away. It's not going to just downsize out of sight without a major upheaval, a fairly radical shift in our public consciousness. Now, I know that there's many people, you know, who'll tell me that, oh, well, there's no hope of ending mass incarceration today. There's no hope of that. Just as many people were resigned to Jim Crow in the South and would say, oh, yeah, you know, it's a shame, but that's just the way that it is. I find that today many people view the millions cycling in and out of our prisons and jails as just an unfortunate but inalterable fact of American life. Well, I'm confident that Dr. King and Ella Baker and Ann Braden and so many of those who risked their lives to end the old Jim Crow would not be so easily deterred. So I believe we have got to go back and pick up where they left off and do the hard work of movement building on behalf of poor people of all colors. In 1968, Dr. King told advocates that the time had come to shift from a civil rights movement to a human rights movement. He said, meaningful equality cannot be achieved through civil rights alone without basic human rights, the right to work, the right to shelter, the right to quality education, the right to food. Without basic human rights, civil rights, he said, are an empty promise. So in honor of all those who labored to end the old Jim Crow, I hope we will build a human rights movement, a movement for education, not incarceration, a movement for jobs, not jails, a movement to end all these forms of discrimination against people labeled criminals, discrimination that denies them their basic human rights to work, to shelter, and to food. Now, how do we build this kind of movement, a movement that recognizes the dignity and humanity of each and every one of us, no matter who we are or what we have done? Well, first, I think we have to begin by telling the truth, the whole truth. We have to be willing to admit out loud that we as a nation have managed to recreate a caste-like system in this country. We have to be willing to tell this truth in our churches, in our schools, our places of worship. We have to be willing to tell this truth inside prisons and in reentry centers. We have to be willing to tell this truth in community centers. We need to be willing to acknowledge and tell this truth so that a great awakening can begin, that we can reckon with what we have done, where we are, and where we need to go. But of course, just a lot of talk will not be enough. We're going to have to get to work and take some action. So I believe we have got to be willing to build an underground railroad for people returning home from prison and attempting to make a genuine break for freedom. We have got to be willing to open our hearts, open our arms, open our doors to people returning home from prison and provide help, support, and finding work, finding shelter, getting access to food. And we've got to be willing to do this with an open heart, with love. So many people returning home from prison will say, you know, all those legal forms of discrimination, that's not even the worst of it. It's not even the worst. It's the shame and stigma that follows you for the rest of your life. That's the worst. It's the shame of having to say, no matter how many years that have gone by, yeah, I'm a felon. It's that shame and stigma that causes so many people, branded criminals and felons, to try to pass. You know, during the Jim Crow era, light-skinned blacks would try to pass as whites in order to avoid the shame and stigma and discrimination associated with race. Well, today, so many people, branded criminals and felons, try to pass not just by lying to employers or housing officials by, you know, failing to check that box on employment applications or housing applications, but by lying, denying, avoiding with friends, with family members, with loved ones. There's a fascinating ethnographic study conducted in Washington, D.C. of neighborhoods hardest hit by mass incarceration. I mean, these are neighborhoods where literally every other house or apartment has a family member who's either currently behind bars or recently released from prison. I mean, neighborhoods where incarceration is so normal that you just expect people to be talking all the time about who's in, who's out. And to a large extent, that's true. But even in these neighborhoods, they were unable to find one person, not one, who had fully come out to their friends, neighbors, loved ones about their own criminal history or that of their loved ones. Children, when asked by a relative, "Hey, where's your daddy? I haven't seen your daddy in a long time. Where's your daddy? Where's your daddy at?" Child would look down and say, "My daddy? I don't know where my daddy is." Knowing full well their father's in prison. People returning home from prison would run into a neighbor, former co-worker on the street, and they'd say, "Oh, my, I haven't seen you in years. Where have you been? How have you been?" "Oh, I've been fine, I've been fine. Where have you been? I haven't seen you in so long." "Oh, I've been out of town. I'll talk to you later. I was out of town." It's that shame and stigma that keeps so many blaming and shaming one another, denying, avoiding. It creates a silence, even in the communities most affected by mass incarceration, a silence that makes collective political action next to impossible. So if we're going to be serious about building a movement that will end this thoroughly punitive system, we're going to have to find a way to create safe places in our communities for people returning home from prison, safe places for family members who are struggling with grief as loved ones are behind bars, safe places where people feel okay saying, "Yes, I've done time in prison," places where they can admit where their father is doing time. And unfortunately, many people released from prison will tell me that church is the last place they would go following release from prison. Say, "Church is one place I feel most ashamed, most stigmatized. I feel most judged." So we have a lot of work to do in creating safe places where people feel welcome in this era of mass incarceration. And how can we create those safe places? Well, one way is to begin admitting our own criminality out loud. Our own criminality. Because the reality is that we're all criminals. We're all sinners. We've all made mistakes in our lives. And many people will say, "Oh, yeah, okay, I'm a sinner, but don't call me a criminal. I'm not a criminal. I'll say, "Well, okay. Well, maybe you never drank underage. Maybe you never experimented with drugs. But if the worst thing you've ever done in your life is speed 10 miles over the speed limit on the freeway, you've put yourself and others at more risk of harm than someone smoking marijuana in the privacy of their living room. But there are people in the United States doing life sentences for first-time drug offenses. Life sentences. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld life sentences for first-time drug offenders against a challenge that such a sentence is cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled, no, it's not cruel and unusual punishment to send a young man to prison for the rest of his life for a first-time drug offense, even though virtually no other country in the world does such a thing. So rather than shaming and blaming and imagining that the criminals are them, not us, perhaps we ought to say, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." All of us have made mistakes in our lives, but only some of us are expected to pay for those mistakes for the rest of our lives. Now, just creating safe places isn't going to be enough. Just as in the days of slavery, it wasn't enough to build an underground railroad and shuttle a few to freedom. You had to be willing to work for abolition. Today, I believe we have got to be willing to work for the abolition of this system of mass incarceration as a whole. We have got to reimagine our criminal justice system one in which genuine restoration and rehabilitation is possible rather than a site of dehumanization and pure despair. Now, what does it mean to end the system of mass incarceration? Well, it means to end the war on drugs. We've spent $1 trillion waging this war, destroyed millions of people's lives, and yet rates of drug addiction and drug abuse are largely unchanged. It's time to shift to a public health model for dealing with drug addiction and drug abuse. And we've got to end all these forms of legal discrimination against people released from prison, discrimination that denies them their basic human rights to work, to shelter, and food. And last but definitely not least, we have to shift from a purely punitive approach to dealing with violence and violent crime in our communities to a more restorative approach, one that takes seriously the interests of the victim, the offender, and the community as a whole. We have got a lot of work to do. And if it feels like too much, if it feels like we cannot possibly deal with this crisis, say, remember this. All of these rules, laws, policies, and practices that comprise this system of mass incarceration, they all rest upon one core belief. And it is the same core belief that sustained Jim Crow. It's the belief that some of us are not worthy of genuine care, compassion, and concern. And when we effectively challenge that core belief, this whole system begins to fall like dominoes. A multiracial, multiethnic human rights movement must be born, one that takes seriously the dignity and humanity of all people. And it has got to be multiracial and multiethnic. Because although this war on drugs may have been born with black folks in mind, it is a war that has destroyed the lives of people and communities of all colors. A young kid, young white kid, who's facing prison time for a drug offense rather than getting the drug treatment he desperately needs but cannot afford, is suffering because of a drug war declared with black folks in mind. And we see today the same get-tough rhetoric and divisive politics exploiting the anxieties of racial groups, leading to another prison building boom today, this one aimed at suspected illegal immigrants. So we've got to connect the dots and build a multiracial, multiethnic human rights movement on behalf of all of us. But before this movement can even get underway, a great awakening is required. We have got to awaken from this colorblind slumber that we've been in to the realities of race in America. And we have got to be willing to embrace those labeled criminals, not necessarily all their behavior, but them, their humanness. For it has been the refusal and failure to recognize the dignity and humanity of all people that has formed the sturdy foundation for every caste system that has ever existed in the United States or anywhere else in the world. It's our task, I firmly believe, to end not just the war on drugs, not just the system of mass incarceration, but to end this history and cycle of caste in America. Thank you so much for having me here tonight. Thank you.
So much for those comments. We do have time for a few questions before we end tonight, so if you can take your seats, we'll stay for a few moments and have an opportunity for anyone who would like to ask a brief question. We have microphones in the aisles here. We just ask you to come down to the microphone, introduce yourself to our speaker, and ask a brief question. We will take a few questions right now.
Professor Alexander, I'm Tim Barr, director of the John and Sandra Moline Center for Servant Leadership here at TLU. Knowing that there are so many students in the audience, I wondered if there might be one or two things that you would recommend that students do after being here, maybe words of advice or just actions that you would encourage them to take.
Yes, absolutely. You know, there are, I think it's so critically important for young people to not just be engaged, but emerge as leaders in building this movement. You know, throughout history, it has been young people who have been most willing to challenge the status quo, to question the existing social order, and to be willing to be bold and courageous at a time when others are complacent and silent. And so it is with great hope that, you know, I look out and I see young people who are clearly committed to these issues and engaging in these issues. And across the country, there are now campus groups forming called Students Against Mass Incarceration on Columbia's campus, at Howard, a number of campuses across the country. Students are coming together and asking themselves, what is our role in building this movement? What is our contribution at this moment in our history? What is our voice? What is our voice at this time? And there have been a range of ideas that have emerged about how students can have a major impact. Some student groups are thinking seriously about launching divestment campaigns. And of course, many of you are too young to remember the divestment campaigns that were launched by students, which helped to bring an end to apartheid in South Africa. But these divestment campaigns were urging universities to divest from any fund or holding that might benefit South Africa directly or indirectly. And today, you know, universities across the country are often invested in pension plans, invested in mutual funds that benefit private prisons. And so there's a lot of talk about, you know, developing divestment campaigns aimed at encouraging divestment from any mutual fund pension plan that might be benefiting private prisons as a way of raising awareness, not just about the role of private prisons and profit in driving kind of the incarceration machine, but also as a method of, you know, forcing a public conversation about the system of mass incarceration as a whole. So, you know, I urge young people who are interested in learning more and connecting with other students to get connected with Students Against Mass Incarceration and join the emerging national conversation among young people about how to really join this movement.
I know that after a lot of the mental hospitals were closed and stuff, people would become cataloged and warehoused in our prisons.
Yes.
What is a way that we can, how does that kind of fit into the role of racial mass incarceration, and how do we address that?
Yes, that's an excellent question. You're absolutely right that, you know, at the time that many mental, you know, institutions were being closed, and there was this process of deinstitutionalization that, you know, rather than providing people who did have serious mental health problems the support and resources that they need in order to successfully live outside of institutions and manage their lives, and so they were just turned out onto the streets. And many of those folks not only wound up homeless, but, you know, found themselves incarcerated over, you know, petty crimes, petty theft, those kinds of things, crimes really of survival, and found themselves cycling in and out of the prison system. So they weren't so much deinstitutionalized, but the nature of the institution in which they were held changed from mental hospitals to prisons. And so I think, you know, one way of understanding how that came to pass is that, you know, we may have changed our rules and policies, but our general attitudes about poor people and what they deserve did not change so much. And as a result, impoverished people who did not have the benefit of wealthy relatives who might be able to support them or provide them access to treatment programs, et cetera, were viewed as largely disposable. And, you know, in my view, mass incarceration really is at its core about the disposal of extraordinarily large numbers of people, writing them off, imagining that this is a population we need not care about. And poor people who are, you know, struggling with mental illness are among those that we have written off and viewed as disposable.
Hi. I know you mentioned bringing awareness about the situation, but what other appropriate actions do you suggest that we as a society should do to adjust or change our criminal justice system?
Well, in terms of kind of change in actual law and policy, my own view is that we need a radical overhaul of our drug laws to begin with. I don't think anyone who is, you know, caught with mere possession of drugs for personal use of any kind should be branded a felon for life. I'm not arguing in favor of legalization across the board, but I'd say at worst, you would have a misdemeanor. You would not have a felony record that would brand you and make it difficult for you to survive, thus aggravating, perhaps, the very circumstances and conditions which may be contributing to your addiction and, you know, to the recovery process. That shifting to a public health model for dealing with drug addiction and drug abuse means, you know, breaking this habit of thinking of people who are abusing drugs as criminals. We don't think of alcoholics as criminals. We think of them as people who are in need of intervention, help, and support and treatment. And there is no rational reason for us to think of people who are addicted to other substances as criminals, except for, you know, but for the political environment in which the labeling and the stigmatization occurred. So shifting to public health model would do a tremendous amount to, you know, break this cycle of criminalization and the, you know, large undercast that has emerged. You know, many people, you know, have said to me, well, you know, in many states, as much as half of the prison population, you know, are classified as violent offenders, so would it really help that much, you know, simply to remove nonviolent drug offenders from the picture? And it would help much more than people realize. Why? Well, although, you know, violent offenders may comprise as much as half of any state prison population, they comprise a large share of the prison population because they typically get longer sentences than nonviolent offenders. So they comprise a much larger percentage of the prison population than they would if they had shorter sentences like nonviolent drug offenders. But the overwhelming majority of people who are arrested for nonviolent, relatively minor offenses. You know, so for example, we now have a prison population of about 2.3 million. We started off with a prison population about 300,000, you know, in the 70s. We now have one over 2.3 million. But if you consider the number of people who are under correctional control who have been branded criminals, we have 7.8 million people under correctional control. Only about 1.7 million of them are in prison. The rest are in jail, on probation, or parole. All of those folks have been branded criminals and are subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. So if we're talking about dismantling this caste-like system, I think ending the drug war, which is often kind of the point of entry for most people into the criminal justice system today, you know, it would be a huge leap forward. And, you know, examples of other laws that can be changed are, you know, there have been successful Ban the Box campaigns in many cities. You know, Ban the Box means eliminating the box on employment applications asking that question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Employers are still allowed to consider past criminal history after you've at least been granted an interview. But by removing the box from employment applications, at least gives people with criminal records a chance to get their foot in the door and be able to be considered for jobs. So Ban the Box campaigns, we absolutely need to repeal the federal law banning people from access to food stamps. We need, I think, to view housing as a fundamental human right so that people who are released from prison are not systematically excluded from access to housing and forced into homelessness. So those are, you know, specific kind of policies that have to be changed and reversed if we're going to dismantle this system piece by piece.
You said I had to introduce myself, correct?
That would be good.
Okay. Well, my name is John Paul. It was actually kind of funny that you mentioned this, and it was kind of ironic that I came here. I've actually graduated from the police academy, and my brother is a lieutenant in the San Antonio Police Department. Hmm. So I haven't actually been informed of some of this knowledge beforehand, and now I actually have a lot of questions for my brother. But back to my question, where do you think our focus actually needs to be? I understand that you are trying to reform, and overall it is a very good thing to do because of what everything has gone and what the effects of everything is that this is actually done over the several decades that has been, well, appeared, yeah. I guess you could say. So where does this focus need to be? Would rehabilitation centers need to be more prevalent? Would, instead of investing into these prisons and high security areas, do you think the investments that we're putting towards there should be put into other areas such as rehabilitation and things like that?
Absolutely. Excellent question. There's so much that needs to be done that, you know, I hesitate to say this is the most important thing, the thing that has to be done first. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and needs to be done in tandem. And when advocates say, well, what is the most important issue we should be focusing on now? I say, well, actually, it's not so much which issue you pick to focus on, but the way in which you do the work. So if you're working to ban the box unemployment applications, be sure that in your advocacy and everything that you say publicly about what you're doing, you're making it clear that you're not just seeking to end the ban the box. You're seeking, through your work, to help end this entire caste-like system that's been created, and this is one piece of it. Or if you're working to eliminate felonies from your drug possession, that you're saying, I'm doing this work because I'm interested in unraveling this massive system of incarceration that locks people up and locks them out for life. So that there's a public awareness that's created, that it isn't simply isolated policies that need to be tinkered with or fixed, but that the project is much larger than that. And, you know, that was relatively obvious during the Jim Crow era, you know, when people were challenging, you know, laws that required them to sit at the back of the bus. It was well understood that they weren't just challenging that. They were really challenging the system of Jim Crow in its entirety. We have to, because of the nature of the system, it appears colorblind on its surface, we have to make explicit that these policies and practices are interconnected, and that when we're challenging one, what we really are seeking to do is to make visible and dismantle the entire system and create a new moral consensus that would support a more restorative system of justice, a more compassionate and rehabilitative one. But as to your point about kind of funding and where resources go, we absolutely need to reinvest the money that is saved by closing prisons into education, job creation, drug treatment, rehabilitation, and restorative justice programs. Today, the temptation is overwhelming to simply close prisons or downsize a little bit in order to save cash and, you know, balance state budgets, with, you know, an unwillingness then to take that money and reinvest it into the communities that have been so hard hit by the system of mass incarceration. And I think, you know, as advocates, we have to resist the temptation to say, oh, sure, you'll save money. You'll save money by making these reforms. And instead say, it's not about saving money. It's about making different kinds of choices about how we use these funds, because there's a lot of damage in these communities that is now in need of repair. So I do think that there's going to have to be a very deliberate effort to, you know, as our movement becomes more successful, you know, channeling money that is saved from closing prisons and downsizing the system and channeling it into education, drug treatment, job creation, and restorative justice approaches to dealing with violence in our communities. So thank you.
With apologies to those who are waiting in line, we're going to shift our discussion to the foyer and let our guest speaker be in the foyer to continue conversation and to sign copies of her books, which are for sale. I hope that you'll all join me in saying again a thank you to Michelle Alexander. And a reminder that the symposium continues at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning here in Jackson Auditorium. Thank you again.